Today, Blue Origin, that's Jeff Bezos' space company, launched its 11th human flight, an 11-minute trip to the edge of space with an all-female crew made up of celebrities and science advocates, including pop star Katy Perry, journalist Gayle King, civil rights activist Amanda Nguyen, aerospace engineer Aisha Bowe, filmmaker Carrie Ann Flynn, and Bezos' fiance, Lauren Sanchez. Joining us now is professor of astrophysics, Adam Frank, here to talk about what this flight means for the future of space tourism and whether any of it should really be called space travel at all. Professor, welcome to the show. Thanks for making time today.
It's a pleasure.
Is this really space? Pretty low orbit, suborbital flight, right? Only 11 minutes. Does that really count? Isn't this the kind of thing that they use to film zero gravity in Hollywood movies? Isn't this kind of routine at this point?
No, actually, this is still high enough that jet fighters can't, or jet travel can't get to by quite a bit. So, you know, this is what they reached past what's called the von Karman line, which is definitely an arbitrary scientific designation of where space begins. The von Karman line is where you have, when you're thinking about how to control a vehicle, you stop worrying about atmosphere. Right. Mm-hmm. But it still is, you know, these kinds of what we call suborbital flights are still the, you know, the entryway into space. It's what in the early 1960s, the first astronauts and cosmonauts, when they did these kinds of flights, these were considered to be getting into space, getting to be the stepping stone to orbital flight. So I think it's okay to call this getting into space. Right. I don't have a problem with it.
Okay, cool. If you don't, then I don't. So other than the sort of PR value of this, what does a suborbital flight like this actually show us about space? What can we learn from flights like this?
You know, I don't think there's really much to learn anymore about this. As you said, it's becoming routine, which is fantastic, right? We've actually passed the point where, you know, every time we put something into space or into orbit, we've got to be like, what incredible new things have we learned? It's like, you know, it used to be that if you flew in a jet at 5 miles above the ground, there was a huge amount of science to be done. Now you just play video games or watch a movie, right? That's the way we progress. So what's really happening here is you're seeing the beginning of the commercial use of space. In this case, you know, it's still kind of a stunt, you know, sending Katy Perry into space. Mm-hmm. But what it shows is that, you know, in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, if we make it, right, if humanity manages to still be around and civilization is still intact, then, yeah, we could have a viable human presence in space where everybody could go.
Do you see value in sending celebrities into space? You know, if this was an all-female crew of only scientists or only engineers, we probably wouldn't be talking about it quite as much, right? Can a journey like this with a crew like this actually help inspire people to care about science?
Well, yes, I think it does. I mean, it's certainly helpful to have that kind of visibility to make people understand what's happening. You know, it's really not about science anymore. Really what this is about this sort of transition that humanity is taking. Again, if we can survive, we are actually right now, I have to say, American science, it's not clear that America is going to be able to do this in 30 years if we keep the way that we're going, eliminating American science. But, you know, assuming that we do, then, like I said, this is the beginning of humanity sort of using space in a day-to-day fashion, the way, you know, jet travel is not a big deal. And that would be a significant transition because it wouldn't just be Earth orbit. We'd start to talk about living on the moon. We'd start to talk about people living, you know, on Mars. Or, you know, in 300 years, it's not hard to imagine having millions, hundreds of millions of people living on other parts, in other parts of the solar system.
Yeah. Cool. We heard that Oprah, who is very close to Gayle King, Oprah was moved to tears. She cried during the launch. Why do you think people have such emotional reactions to space travel?
Well, I think the essential thing about space travel comes down to this thing called the overview effect that, you know, once you get into space, what you realize is, you know, you look down, you don't see little lines drawn on the planet of like, oh, this is that guy's country and that's the other guy's country. You know, like the planet is a whole. And, you know, these distinctions that human beings make and then, you know, beat the pants off each other over are completely arbitrary and make no sense. And, you know, ultimately, right? And so you recognize that, like, the Earth is this jewel hanging in space, that it is unlike any other planet we've ever found. And for a moment, you get past your kind of petty, partisan sort of, you know, biases and prejudices, and you realize that you're just, you know, an inhabitant. You're an animal that has evolved on this planet, that is part of this planet, and that the planet is much more than you are.
Yeah, I love that idea, that it is actually possible to physically, maybe even geographically is maybe the word to use, escape the condition where we're always sorting ourselves by our disagreements, where it's religion or politics or race or ethnicity or sexuality or gender expression, whatever. None of that matters when you're in space. If all, what are there, 7-8 billion of us now? If all 8 billion of us just all went into space one afternoon and came back, what a different world we would find waiting for us.
I think that's really what it is. There's the what space travel offers is this overview that lifts us out of our kind of petty day-to-day concerns. And we recognize two things. One, that, as you said, the distinctions between us are, you know, minuscule compared to our commonality, which is we're all inhabitants briefly of this planet. And then the second thing is that the planet itself is this amazing, powerful entity thing that, you know, we mess with at our own peril. You know, you really see the planet as being something way more than just this place for us to muck around on, and that, you know, you don't want to actually put its ability to protect human civilization in danger.
Professor, last week on the program here, we had a couple great conversations about moments where people have experienced the sublime. Whether that was, the birth of their child, or, you know, being at their parents' bedside when they slipped away, or also it could be something more beautiful or awe-inspiring or terrifying. And I'm reading this morning about what some people call the overview effect, where can you just explain to us what that is in your words and how that can tie into people experiencing the sublime?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of the sublime. That's what, you know, my experience of science has always been an experience of the sublime. You know, the sublime is the sense of unity, of there being more, you know, however you want to define more. If you're religious, then you'll define more within your, that more in your own tradition. And, you know, if you're not religious, you find it in other ways. But it's that sense that you are connected on some profound level to something so much more than just your petty day-to-day concerns. And the overview effect is that thing that that astronauts describe when they look down on the planet. It's an experience of the sublime, of the spiritual, and I'm a scientist who has no problem using that word, of the spiritual, that you know, there's this, you are just much more than, you know, your story, right? You are part of something much larger. And space, you know, the reason I became an astronomer was the experience of the sublime I had as a kid looking out at the night sky.
If you have a question for my guest, Professor Adam Frank, you can shoot it to me on the Oakenheart Jewelers Talking text line. We'll try and get some of those answered before we step away. Did you see Contact with Jodie Foster and all them back?
Oh my God, yeah.
So
many
good.
Times.
Yeah, me too. It's one of my absolute favorite films, and it'll never ever cease to touch me, that moment where she's on the journey and she sees the swirling cosmic galaxy when she's traveling to Vega, and she's speechless, and she says it's so beautiful, they should have sent a poet.
Right.
That's
right.
The overview effect, then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing is, you know, what's a bummer is these days to see the night sky, really to see it, you got to drive 50 miles out of a city. But, you know, it used to be available to all of us every night. I mean, the Milky Way used to be visible, you know, in Paris in 1200. You know, you can be, because nobody had anything more than fire, torches, right?
Yeah.
So it used to be that the vividness of the night sky, which now we only get when we're, like, camping deep in the woods, that was there every night, and it really blew people away. You recognize, you could just feel the strangeness of the night sky.
Professor Gayle King said that she, quote, cannot call herself an astronaut. Who gets to be called an astronaut?
Oh, anybody. I mean, that's fine that she wants to say that. But, you know, I think at some point, everybody, anybody who goes into space, who, you know, who's an astronaut, who's not an astronaut, I think that's an arbitrary label. I mean, there are certainly the heroes, so to speak, who, you know, will go out, will explore the frontiers of space. And, you know, maybe we want to have a special name for those, you know, the first person who lands on Mars, the people, you know, the first group that lands on the moon and builds a colony or a settlement. I mean, so there's certainly a huge amount of heroism that goes into being the first ones or pushing the limits of human endurance in space. But, you know, I think these are just labels. Who's an astronaut? Who's not an astronaut? Where exactly the boundaries of space are? Those are labels that are kind of fun to argue over, but in the end, they're not all that meaningful.
Here's a text that says, what would working in space look like? Mining or building?
Yeah, well, let's talk about mining. So, you know, one idea that people have had for a while is that we have these asteroids that are floating around out in space. There's, you know, these are basically construction debris left over from the assembly of the planets billions of years ago. And some of them have more, like, say, platinum in them than is, you know, on Earth almost. That's not quite true. But, you know, there's trillions of dollars in platinum on them. So, you know, the idea of mining these asteroids is something that people have even begun to investigate and think about putting money into. So, you know, being a miner in space, you'd probably, you know, live on some kind of orbiting space platform. And then you would, you know, travel out to these asteroids. You'd meet up with one of the asteroids in orbit and then, you know, do the work literally of attaching yourself to it and grinding out rock and then processing the rock. It would look very much like, you know, like mining on Earth, only obviously weightless. Yeah. Etc. Yeah. But there's lots of other jobs as well. There'd be lots of other things to do in space in another 300 years. Even 100 years, there'll be jobs in space.
I like the idea of there being a radio host in space because, man, a pretty small transmitter is going to throw a big footprint, right? I mean, you could go out for a long, long time. Great. We'll take a break in just a second here, Professor Frank. But what you said about, you know, when you get up into space, you look down, you don't see the borders between countries. You don't see red states and blue states. Here's a text message that says, I love this topic, but also tongue in cheek. Wait a minute. Red states aren't actually red? And I thought, well, maybe Utah. Maybe Utah would be close. I don't know. Stick around just 1 minute. Professor Frank is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester and author of The Little Book of Aliens, which I cannot forget to ask him about when we come back. I'm Ian Hoke sitting in for Scoot on WWL. Be right back after this. Adam Frank is on the line with us. Professor Frank, here is a text message that says, where'd it go? Oh, this is from Sparky. Hi, Sparky. Sparky is asking, is it true that Mars doesn't have a magnetic field to protect it from solar radiation? Would this prevent colonization?
Yes, that is, he's absolutely right. Sparky's right. Way to go, Sparky.
Good job, Sparky.
And it's true that the Mars does not have a magnetic field. We can talk about why it doesn't have one. And it barely has an atmosphere. It's got an atmosphere, but it's like a hundredth of the amount of air that we have. And that means that Mars is a very inhospitable place. So the idea that like people like Elon Musk have, that we're going to colonize Mars and have a vibrant human civilization on Mars, is kind of pushing it. That's probably not going to be possible for a very long time. But it doesn't mean that we can't have settlements on Mars, and that maybe, you know, like I said, over a few centuries, we might figure out how to, like, underground have, you know, large human presence on Mars. So, but right now, yeah, really, you could not build something on the surface of Mars that would allow you to live, you know, free from the radiation exposure from the sun.
I kind of like the vision of Mars that Ray Bradbury laid out in The Martian Chronicles, right? Which he was writing in like 1949. I mean, just like early space age. And his vision of Mars is that it's mostly populated by just tall humans. Like the Martians are just tall people, and they have houses and they have children and families and barbecues. Here's a text that says, "How flat is the Earth, and can you see the flatness from outer space?"
Yes, how shall we answer that? The funniest part is whoever wrote that, you know, used a high performance piece of scientific equipment. Probably the message might have even been bounced off a satellite and back down.
Indeed.
So, yeah, so that pretty much answers that question about the flat Earth.
You're right. We don't have to dwell on it, but I thought it was funny.
No,
okay, great.
That is funny.
Back to business. Are we in danger of turning space travel into something that is only available for the ultra wealthy? Or is this just kind of a necessary step on the way to broader access for just regular people?
That's a good question. I think right now it's not that we're in danger. Already that's what it is. Like at this point,
sure,
you know,
that's fair. Yeah.
There, space tourism is just beginning. And in the beginning is absolutely positively only going to be for really rich people. Like working class folks are just not going to be able to space take that trip. But, you know, in time, that was probably the way it was with air travel in the beginning as well. You had to be fairly wealthy to be able to travel. And, you know, the hope would be, I think, and the expectation will be that over time, especially as there starts to become jobs up there, that space will become accessible to all kinds of people. I mean, I think we have to be very careful about billionaires, you know, as we've seen, and billionaires sort of deciding for themselves how they want society to be organized. But I do believe that in the beginning, this is a necessary first step to the commercialization of space, which I'm very much in favor of.
I wonder, they landed somewhere in West Texas. I as much as I read about this story this morning, I don't know where they took off and landed from. Do you?
Actually, I don't know where. Huh. I thought the launch facilities were in California, but I may be wrong about that.
Okay.
You know, does.
Sorry, I see it here. Yeah, it's Bezos has a private ranch in West Texas known as Launch Site 1. So they took off and landed in sort of the same space. But look, the reason I asked is I wanted to know, you know, is this the kind of flight that could be useful, not for just tourism or PR stunt, but for travel? Like if I wanted to go to, you know, Paris, France in 11 minutes. Could I do that just by going up in this kind of capsule and just taking kind of a wider arc than they took this morning?
Well, there are ideas for that. Hypersonic travel, they call it. The idea of, you know, sort of, you know, rather than, you know, getting up to the stratosphere, which is like 5 miles or so. You know, right now, pretty much when you fly in an airplane, you're flying at 5 miles above the ground, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But that's not really much higher, or that's about the same height as Mount Everest, right?
Mm.
But if you could actually do this kind of arc, if you could get into suborbital space and come back down, you could have, like you said, it would be only, you know, 20 minutes to get to Paris or something.
Yeah.
So that is definitely something that people are thinking about. There are environmental problems with that. Because every time you do that, you're kind of punching a hole in the atmosphere, and that can actually lead to some problems perhaps for the ozone layer.
Oh,
so
no.
We're not really sure. Yes. Well, you know, in general, air travel is pretty bad for the atmosphere, right? We know that it's a major contributor to climate change.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of other things that, you know, so, you know, this is the thing. If you want to have a giant, powerful human technological civilization, you just have to pay attention to the side effects. There's got to be side effects on the planet. So that's something we need to learn how to manage.
Man, everything's always got side effects. You know, life would be so much easier if stuff just didn't do that. I got three more questions for you, and we're kind of running out of time, Professor, so I want to go quickly. Going back to Mars, the audience does want you to briefly explain, why is sun radiation on Mars life prohibitive, but Mars is farther away from the sun than Earth is?
That's a great question. Wow, you got a smart audience. The solar radiation that's being blown off the surface of the sun, even though Mars is further away, there's still enough of it that it would be harmful for life. In fact, almost anywhere you go in the solar system, there's still enough what we call ionizing radiation that can just like punch right through your body and start to cause mutations, you know, that could give cancer. anywhere. The reason we don't have to worry about it on Earth is we've got this beautiful atmosphere and an ozone layer and a magnetic field, which all protect us from it.
And Mars has almost none of those things.
Yeah, it has no magnetic field, and it's got almost no atmosphere.
A tiny, tiny atmosphere. Okay, what's your favorite space movie?
Oh, my God. So many. I don't even know where to begin. It's not fair. Everybody should watch the show The Expanse on Amazon Prime.
Right.
It's Game of Thrones in space.
What?
And it takes place about 300 years from now. And it's really, it's a beautiful, scientifically accurate vision of what a settled solar system would look like. And it's got great space battles.
You had me at Game of Thrones in space. Okay, great. And just lastly, Professor, and take your time. I'll give you some runway with this. Tell us about your book, The Little Book of Aliens. What's in there?
Yeah, well, listen, everybody, the book starts off with the fact that everybody loves aliens, right? That's the first line, because everybody does love aliens. And what I wanted to give people is a view into how close scientifically we are to being able to find whether or not there's life on other planets or not. Like in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we are going to have data from telescopes that will tell us whether or not other planets might have other life. And so I wanted to show people, this is a field called astrobiology. Yeah. I wanted people to see how close they're getting. And I also talk about UFOs and UAPs, and I tried to give people like the real science, not the hype, because there's so much hype, about what we know and what we don't know and what we might know.
Well, I hope that when we know it, we send Jodie Foster and not Katy Perry. But that's that's just me. Thanks for spending time with us today, Professor Frank. It's a great conversation. We'll be looking out for your book, The Little Book of Aliens, and we'll keep you in the Rolodex, man. Nice speaking with you today.
It was good talking with you, too. Take care.
Adam Frank is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester and author of The Little Book of Aliens. Might have a chance to read one or two text messages, maybe even take a call before we hand it off to Chris Miller in the 2 o'clock news. At 2:10, we'll do the news bomb. A lot to talk about there today in national and international headlines, political and otherwise. At 2:20, we'll talk to Pike Howard, who's the owner of Felipe's Taqueria, about the shooting after the French Quarter Festival. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. Be right back after this.